Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, one of the most popular movie talk shows on the internet and on iTunes. Tonight, he's appeared in films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Weird Science, but his role as Pluto in Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes made him a horror fan favorite, actor Michael Berryman. Plus, from Blood Car, the new independent horror film everyone's talking about, writer-director Alex Orr and co-star Katie Rowlett. Got a question for the geeks or any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or check out our chat page now. Now sit back, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Welcome to another great Wednesday night edition of Movie Geeks United. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I'm very excited about tonight's show.
I am too. This is going to be a great one. A couple of notes before we get started tonight. Our chat room is up. I know a lot of people are excited about the guests we have on this evening. So if you have any questions and you're too shy to call in, which I know a lot of our listeners, quite a few of our listeners that we hear from after these shows say, you know, I would have called in, but I'm shaking like a leaf, which, you know, we understand that. Our chat room is up, so if you have any questions you want to submit through our chat room, we'll be monitoring it throughout the show if you'd like to do that. And also, you can subscribe to Movie Geeks United through iTunes, absolutely free. You can access all of our past shows, like our interviews with Howard Shore and Joe Pantoliano and John Badham interview last week, and our two-hour tributes to Pacino and David Lynch and Brian De Palma, and just great content. So The Hills Have Eyes. Let's talk about that for a little bit, Jerry. I just recently rewatched that film, and what an amazingly powerful movie.
It is. We watched it on, I guess, on home video in January 1987. I watched it.
Yeah.
And we watched it, and it really scared me. And then everyone went to New York for the day. The day after that, and I came home from like school.
Yeah.
To an empty house. I was freaking out. Because I still had the memories of that movie. It was just like a really freaky night for me.
It's very telling, and those are moments that you never forget. And it stays with you, like the best horror films. I mean, it stays with you. It's not just something that you carry out of the theater.
Oh yeah, that film still, even when I was watching the remake a couple of years ago, the memories of that movie, there are some scenes in that film that paralyzed me with fear.
Absolutely. So we have a great show tonight. Let's get it started. We're really excited about this. Our first guest tonight is a wonderful character actor who's appeared in a string of terrific films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Weird Science, and Rob Zombie's The Devil's Rejects, and landmark television shows like Star Trek, The Next Generation, Highway to Heaven, and The X-Files. But it's his role as Pluto in Wes Craven's 1977 classic The Hills Have Eyes that transformed him into a true icon of the horror genre. The role of Pluto earned him a Saturn nomination for Best Actor and the praise of horror fans worldwide. Wes Craven called him one of the nicest and smartest guys you could ever hope to meet. This tremendous and much-beloved talent will be appearing at Screamfest in Orlando, Florida this weekend, but tonight he's spending some time with the movie geeks. It is our great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Michael Berryman. Mr. Berryman, hi.
Hey, good evening. Good evening, Jerry and Jamie.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight. We're really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with you. I want to start out, and this surprised me, and I'm sure you've been approached on this quite a bit, but you started out before you made a decision to go into the acting profession. You started out, you were a florist, or you owned a plant shop. Is that true?
I actually had a small gift shop and plant shop for indoor plants with a business partner of mine. A gal from Beverly Hills, and we were on West Washington Boulevard, right downtown Venice Beach.
Uh-huh.
And across the street was an antique store called the Gallimaufry, and that's where I met George Powell.
Mm.
Wow.
Wow. So was there ever, did you have aspirations to go into acting earlier, before that period, or not?
Well, actually, I was kind of shy when I graduated from high school, and then I went to college for a while. Then I came back to L.A., and that's when I opened up the shop. I was pretty much because of my physical characteristics growing up as a kid, I always attracted attention.
Mm.
So as I got into college, I appreciated open-mindedness, intelligent people, and broader horizons, so to speak, for the future.
Right.
So my intrigue was to make some money, go back to L.A. I grew up in Santa Monica, and I wanted to raise some money and move to Alaska and be a nature photographer and maybe get in on a homestead, because I just I grew up on, like a Thoreau. I always wanted to be in the mountains.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Well, isn't it amazing how life turns out sometimes?
Well, it is. I had a lot of friends that were in old Hollywood that were contract players for Disney, for instance, Antonio Caruso, Ray Montgomery. He'd done some Twilight Zones and Gunsmoke, things of that nature. So I knew people in the business, but not intimately in a working capability. They were more like friends of the family.
Right. But, well, your first, I know you did some work previous to it, but your first major film, I suppose it's safe to say, was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, that's correct. That was actually my second day at work, my first day at work. I was discovered by George Powell, whose son and daughter-in-law owned the store across the street from me. That's how I met him.
Uh-huh.
And he said, Michael, it's good to meet you. And he basically handed me his card, and he said, you have a unique look. I think I could put you in a movie that I'm doing, and I would be glad if you called me. And I did, and we worked. I got to work with Ron Ely. And Doc Savage is kind of a pulp novel.
Right.
I have a copy of that actually on the shelf in my room right now.
It's a real collectible.
Yeah.
It's very campy and very classy. But I didn't think I would have a career after that, actually. But ironically, the casting directors from Doc Savage were casting for a new movie, which happened to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm.
I was cast by the producers, so I never met Mike Fenton and Gene Feinberg. So when they called me at home, I wasn't quite sure who they were.
Mm.
And then they explained to me about Cuckoo's Nest and the Douglases were involved, and I just had to ask them if Nicholson was going to play McMurphy, and they said yes, and I was just, what do I need to do to wind up in Oregon and be on the project? And they said, well, come down to Ocean Park and have a meeting and meet Saul Zance and Milos Forman and Michael and Joel Douglas. And
uh-huh.
I did, and then they said, terrific, we'll see you in Salem, Oregon. We'll send you we'll send you a ticket and information. Oh, and by the way, you have to get an agent. That was interesting. I didn't know.
That's the kicker.
Yeah. Well, Cuckoo is undeniably, it goes without saying, one of our great classic movies. And I think the fact that you guys shot in a real mental facility in Oregon made the film a transcendent experience. And I would imagine shooting it as an actor in that environment had the same effect on you.
It had a tremendous effect on everybody. We had about 130 people, cast and crew. And I was there for, 4 months. But the ambiance of the real facility, we had 2 weeks of rehearsals of major scenes. And then during that time, we had to take an hour or two with just a group of actors. And the chronics, for instance, we had to spend time with real patients that were incarcerated. I spent like an hour and a half talking to a young man who was an artist with a orderly in the window of his door watching me every moment in case the guy did something. And he had torched a church, I think it was, but he was insane. So we had to get into their mind. So this young gentleman would he painted. He drew pictures. So I would ask him about his pictures. I had a minor in art in college, and I had an opportunity to get into his mind. And I don't think that. And then we would switch rooms. And the doctor, by the way, Dr. Spivey, was the real doctor of that hospital.
Yeah. And one of the absolutely classic scenes involved Nicholson and the Dr. Spivey in one of the first scenes of the film.
Oh, absolutely.
I've never seen a more, and probably because it was largely improvisational, but a more naturally performed scene in my life than that first scene there.
You know, I have to agree, because when I saw it in the theater, when it was in general release, I had that same feeling. Hung on me like a comfortable coat. That scene just sort of sits with the audience very comfortably, and you really get into the room with them. You don't quite understand all of the shenanigans that McMurphy is up to, or the importance of his jeopardy. The doctor, you know, he's very specific, and you know, Jack's character, of course, doesn't really get the full. Appreciation of where he is until later.
Yeah, and it really sets the tone for the kind of realism. Like you said, you're in that hospital, and you just get that sense. Tell me about Milos Forman, and of course working with Jack Nicholson as well.
When I had the meeting with the Douglases, Saul Zantz, and Milos, it was the first time I'd met a director that was non-American.
Right.
he smoked a pipe. He looked kind of avant-garde. You know, I think he had a black sweater on.
Mm-hmm.
He just had a demeanor about him that was, it wasn't Hollywood. It was European. And I really had an affinity to it. I just liked how it felt. The meeting felt very, collegiate, but not in the how can I put it? It's more like a university, but in Europe, kind of an effect.
Right.
Right.
I felt that this film, the way it was being approached, the subject matter, it would have an international appeal, and I really liked that. When we had 2 weeks of rehearsals before we rolled film, we were practicing with the lighting and choreography and wardrobe and makeup and all of that. And it was so nice to have 2 weeks of rehearsals of major scenes for blocking, and so we could have a sense of what we were getting into later on when we performed those scenes. Milos had us watch a lot of films, and one of them was his film called Titicut Follies, which is a documentary of a real mental institution back in the snake pit days, and it shows a feeding tube being forced down the through the nose of a patient, real old school kind of incarceration for the mentally impaired, and that kind of was a rude awakening. We also watched The Fireman's Ball, which was Milos's film, to get a feel for how he got into the heart and soul of his characters. The boy, I don't know if you're familiar with that film, but it's very, very touching between the main characters, the boy and the girl.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Milos for a bit of advice, and he said, the best thing I can tell you is to ignore the camera but have a love affair with the lens of the camera. And I took him to heart, so I studied with the cinematographers constantly in the focus pullers, for instance, and asked them they would change the lens. I'd say, what lens is this, please? And what do the numbers mean? And why do you need that lens? And they would let me look through that beautiful Panavision camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, this is what I want to do after that. And then Jack was very, so down home, so honest. I asked him, I said, why did you become an actor? I know you knew Fonda and Hopper and you did Easy Pieces and, you know, easy writer. And he said, Michael, honestly, if I was taller, I would have liked to have been an NBA star.
That makes sense. That makes perfect sense.
That's right. And he seems like, Milos Forman seems like a director that gives you freedom.
Yes, he does.
And Nicholson seems like the you talk about freedom. He seems like the freest of actors.
Yeah, I would have to say Free and Honest.
Yeah.
With deep sincerity, and he's consummate about his character. He really knows his character. A lot of people say, okay, I'm going to live this character, you know. Okay, but Jack identifies with himself, which is also the character. He layers it deeply. He has such fine tuning. As a perfect example of the super close up they have at the end of the movie, when Will and Jack are getting ready to escape,
yeah.
And the window is unlocked, and they're waiting for Billy to take care of his business.
It's a long take.
It's a long, lovely, lovely take, which was probably shot about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And we were all very tired. And I was like about 3 feet out of camera, the edge of frame, watching intently. And it is a very simple shot. And you can see his whole story convey on the emotions in his face.
Yeah.
And then the train, and that was an unscripted take. In other words, that train actually came. We used to hear it at night usually about that time.
Uh-huh.
And it just happened at the perfect moment in that particular take. And Jack's response to it was perfect. And I know inside his head he was going, this will be the one. And I can't wait to get back into my car and get to my hotel. Well, they were living in, they rented big houses in town, Michael and everybody, because they were there for a long, long time, so they wanted
yeah.
to feel at home. And I was just blown away by the sincerity of a magical moment.
Mm-hmm.
And Milos allows those magical moments to take place, and he guides you to the area. And if you're sincere and you trust him to capture,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't like you looking at him or looking at the lens, per se, unless he wants one right down the barrel. So he lets you capture it. And again, that fall in love with the lens. So that meant know your framing, know your depth of field, know where your lighting is, know where your movement is, know not to block your other actors and lines, all the technical stuff. But more than that, it's to create the character and really become enamored with the character and then be honest in your moment. And Jack's honesty in that moment was tremendous. And then, of course, the close-up with the nurse when she's angry with him. There were some incredible moments in that.
It really is. And this reminds me of a discussion that we just had during our last weekend show. We were talking about the definition of a great actor or, you know, a movie star, what have you. And to be able to hold the screen without saying a word.
Absolutely. That's exactly what the window scene when he smiles and he just goes,
yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit of a,
yeah.
Yeah, that is a consummate professional.
So was it a tough thing to shake when shooting was completed for you? The whole mood of being in that atmosphere?
There was a running joke that we would actually have a floor all to ourselves when we were finished. That was actually true. We found out some things about how the way patients were treated. There were some situations that we didn't think were too cool. We also found out that the patients, you know, they're not criminals.
Right.
They are people that have mental illnesses,
mm-hmm.
and they don't deserve to be mistreated.
Mm-hmm.
On another show, we could discuss nutrition versus pills,
right.
versus big industry, versus society's responsibilities to our brothers and sisters. That would be another show. It'd take about 2 days. But,
yeah, you're right. You're right there.
We're open for it. So.
Yeah, hey, I got time.
Oh, I can rant. In Oregon, during the winter, it's so cold, if they have to just take someone to the hospital and back to the dorms, and they're at a different building, they have tunnels.
Uh-huh.
Well, the tunnels become an underground for the patients to have. They have little parties and stuff. And,
right.
And of course, they have, you know, help from the staff. And I'm sure, you know, the rules, people say, oh, my goodness, the lawyers, we can't let you do. But honestly, they're not criminals. They're human beings. They deserve to have some verve
uh-huh.
in their moments of their
lives. Oh, absolutely.
Lives.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the humanity aspect of Cuckoo's Nest and the rules versus enforcement versus a life,
mm-hmm.
A life to be enjoyed. There was a struggle there, you know?
Yeah. To be a part of cinema history with that film, and of course, you did it again with The Hills Have Eyes.
That was
hell
a
out of
in direction.
Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah. So how did the opportunity to be in The Hills Have Eyes come about for you?
I got a call to meet Wes and Peter.
Mm-hmm.
That's Peter Locke and Wes Craven, and we had a nice chat. And they said, we think you'd be perfect for the part. On physical appearances predominantly, and I understood, and I hadn't had any real big scenes yet as an actor. I did have a wonderful moment toward the end of the movie when Ellis gets drunk, but I used to live out in the high desert, which is where we filmed it. So in the daytime it was hot, and at night it was cold.
Yeah.
So I felt very comfortable in that environment. I knew about certain snakes, certain types of rattlesnakes that are very deadly. I knew about cactus, which certain ones you don't want to get even too close to. And I'd worked with animals before. I had a trained German shepherd, and I had lived at the Wolf Sanctuary up near Big Bear for many, many, many years. So
right.
I was working with Mo DiCesso's dogs, which the German Shepherd, the older one, was, of course, the bionic dog.
That was Jamie Summers' dog?
Yep.
Oh my God. Okay.
Mo DiCesso and his wife were the handlers.
Jamie, you have no idea.
That's major. That's great.
No, it's major. Dude, that episode where the dog saved the kid's life? Okay, never mind. But
okay. watching that movie again recently, I was reminded of just how incredibly powerful it is. And when you watched it in its finished form, for the first time, were you surprised by the power of it, or was that something that you could sense actually on the set as you were doing it?
That's a really valid question. Honestly, over time, an actor will look at a film with about three different sets of eyes. For me, it's even more than that, because I'll look at it like from every person who worked on the film's perspective.
Mm.
And maybe it's my the way my brain is wired, but honestly, yes, I can detach and get into and go, that's not really me, that's not D. Wallace, you know, that predicament they wind up in. My favorite scene that really gets you to the nitty-gritty and holds you there is the moment when the father makes it all the way to Grandpa Fred's gas station.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
He finds him trying to hang himself, and he goes, get your head out of that noose, you jackass. What do you think you're doing? Oh, I thought you're trespassing. You always try to scare away trespassers by trying to hang yourself. And then the guy goes, how's your family? And the father just has no idea what the guy just asked him.
Yeah.
Oh, they're fine. Like hell they are. Well,
and it works because
know.
It
Wait
works
a minute.
Because
That's
of that
scary.
Family dynamic.
Pardon me?
It works because of those family dynamics.
Perfectly right.
Both families.
Yeah.
And I think it also works because Craven, like any great horror director, he creates an environment where the audience does not feel safe. Anything can happen.
Yeah, that and the Last House on the Left, he does that very well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what kind of director was Wes Craven for you? Tell me a little bit about him.
He knows exactly what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He knows exactly what he needs. And he and Peter also, a good idea person, will let you play the part with glee. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
He gives you, he'll give me, marks. I don't want it less than this, and I don't want it more than this in these particular moments and or this particular scenes.
Mm.
And the rest he just kind of leaves up to you. A lot of the blocking is pretty much streamlined through the cinematographer. So emotionally that helped me and my character have space to create. I've worked with some directors that just, they go, well, that was terrific, but we're going to do three more takes because you did, it was this instead of that, and like we changed one word, you know. I mean, just nitpicking. A lot of TV stuff is like that.
Yeah.
But Wes is not that way. And you ask him a question, and he'll relate to the scene through the eyes of your character.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found very comfortable. Wes, he was a teacher, of course, so I found him to be like a college professor kind of a guy, but not stodgy. Mm-hmm. You know, like a college professor away from the university, because he's wickedly smart. Serpent in the Rainbow and the first Freddy movie just did me numbers, man. And I went to the guy's wedding for crying out loud, and I'm going, Wes, what have you done? What have you created? Oh, crap, you're going to give me a nightmare, and I know you. You know,
yeah.
I read this script, and it's going to scare me when I go home.
And
it does consistently over the years.
Absolutely. And anytime I see interviews with Wes Craven, he seems like a gentle soul.
Well, he is.
Yeah. And so it's so odd that he directs horror films so well.
Well, I think he's mentioned in various interviews that I think he came from but it's not in my head right now, sort of a, not Quaker, but just genteel kind of a home life. And
mm-hmm.
He has a wicked sense of humor. And Peter Locke, the two of them together, we had so much fun. Peter's... reminds me of John Steiner? There's a comedian that looks a lot, been around forever, looks a lot like Peter, and he's got a wicked sense of humor and a lovely, lovely smile. He played Mercury. That whole thing when he's counting, Mercury, next time I'll eat that toast. And he gets pushed off, and he's got the feathers on his head.
Yeah.
You think everybody laughs? I mean, he's my executive producer. I mean, and to this day, he's still the same way to you know.
Oh, wow. I have a strange question for you.
Yeah.
I hope you don't think it's that strange. But
oh, I've heard plenty strange.
I know that The Hills Have Eyes had a limited budget. And obviously, when you have a limited budget, you have to shoot fast and do very creative solutions since you don't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
But do you find, because I do, that horror films are more effective when they're done on a smaller budget?
Well, I would say 50% of that, half the time perhaps yes, and half the time perhaps I would opt for a bigger budget because you can really do some.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. We're here.
Okay. You know, because you can really do some cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
there's just something so kind of primal about Hills Have Eyes.
Somebody's trying to call in. I'm not gonna answer.
I'm sorry. There's just something so primal about Hills Have Eyes and Last House and Left and the original Texas Chainsaw, and I think that really has to do too with just you're not dealing with a lot of resources and you have to be very creative. And it's,
well, Not Even Living Dead is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really effective. I mean, there is a director out there, and if anybody runs across him or if you're listening, Mark Pavia, who did a movie called Drag,
uh-huh.
And it was about a woman and her husband who he got, you know, the plague from whatever is floating in the air, and she has him chained in the basement. She goes out hunting for untainted human flesh. It's brilliant. Then Mark was shown around, and Mark Pavia did a movie called Night Flyer.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. And Lance Henriksen's a good buddy. I think I love Lance's work. And Mark is the same way. He made that first movie for just nothing. And yet it's very effective, very minimal. But the way he moves his camera, you know, where he places his camera in the frame, you can do so much by having a little bit of foreground, the cinematography and is critically important,
yeah.
And composition of your shots can add so much. I just picked up the special edition of Frankenstein and the Wolfman series that had just been released, and they're wonderful.
Oh yeah, of course.
Very simple, but nothing is there by happenstance, and that's the beauty of Wes Craven. Now Wes can put a scene together with very little props, very minimalistic. All the moves and stuff can be really, really simple. But trust me, no aspect of it is by chance. Every minute little detail. Rod Serling did a lot of the same.
Right, right. Now, did you see, speaking of old horror, like the Wolfman and Frankenstein with the new horror, did you see the remakes of The Hills Have Eyes, and what were your thoughts on those films? Is that your cell phone?
Oh, hang on. I'm doing a live radio feed on the phone.
Wow.
Okay.
This is live radio. This is great.
Okay.
Anything can happen.
That was my manager.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So did you get a look at the remake of The Hills Have Eyes, and what were your thoughts on that?
I was at the world premiere at the Syracuse Syracuse B Movie Film Festival, and then I went to the world premiere red carpet in L.A. So I'd seen it a few days before. It's a different style. Directors today do things a little differently. They have different equipment and different visual approaches. Honestly, I really liked the beginning quite a bit. I wanted to know more about how the families survived in a nuclear test zone. I appreciated the set dressings, the art direction. It was just really, really cool. And then after a while, the characters became introduced, family and hill people, and of course the soldiers. I felt that nobody was taking their circumstances honestly, and then the family had these really bizarre devices, to entrap and snare and kill their prey.
Right.
And it really seemed like a video game to me.
It turned into First Blood all of a sudden.
Exactly.
Stallone in the woods coming up with all these neat inventions.
Which is kind of funny because, a financial success isn't always, there's financial success, there is artistic success, and then what I feel is have you successfully pleased your horror audience? Because horror audiences read. I have been doing conventions and horror films for 30 years, and I have and sci-fi and horror people are the most educated, most well-versed, and have probably more library cards in their wallet than any other group of people that I could think of aside from a university student.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah.
It is very true. And you can discuss almost any subject with them unabashed and unfiltered, and you're not going to get the type of, can you say crap?
You can say whatever you want. Uncensored.
The same kind of pablum for your brain that you get on most, TV and cable, even though there is some really good stuff out there, but most of it's crap.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that. So you mentioned the conventions. I know you're going to be in Orlando this weekend.
I'm leaving tomorrow morning, Brad. I'll be up at 5 o'clock to get to
Oh,
wow, okay.
Which is actually close to where I am going to be this weekend, too, so I might stop by and say hello.
Oh, yeah, drop by. We have all my friends are there. Bill Moseley, Sid Haig, everybody. It's the whole crowd. Doug Bradley, everybody. Scream Fest is a great, great show. If you've never been, hop on, stick out your thumb, hop on a bus, get on a plane, get there. It's a great show.
It definitely seems to be. The Robert Englund and Gunnar Hansen, the original Leatherface, and are they a community? Are you a community with them?
Yes, we are.
Sorts.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah, we're a giant band of gypsies.
Well, no, that's really nice to hear.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. We all compare notes as far as what shows are good, who's fun to work for, you know, what issues and tissues you have to bring along. And it's very nice to travel and see friends over the years. I just saw Tom Savini last weekend, and it's just delightful because the shows are a lot of energy,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of energy coming toward us, and we give out a lot of energy. And people come to these shows for a to be refilled. I mean, you can find memorabilia from comic books to figurines to posters to movies that you just loved, and maybe your mom threw it out when you went to college, that kind of stuff, and you can retrieve them. Anybody out there listening to this, if you've never been to one of these conventions, go to them. Cinema Wasteland, Scream Fest, Fright Vision, they're tremendous, horrifying. They're all wonderful.
Yeah.
And if you're into sci-fi at all, you can combine them all together with artists and writers, and some of the artwork that some of these people do, aside from clothing, is tremendous. In Atlanta, Georgia, you got to go to Dragon Con if you've never gone.
Oh, I believe
it. Yeah, I have been to Dragon Con.
I need to ask a question.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
What was it like to work with Rob Zombie?
The best. Absolutely the best. Matter of fact, I was hosting the Igor Awards at Universal Studios City Walk in Hollywood last week and a half ago, and I presented Sherry Moon with her award, and Rob was there, and Corey Feldman was there, Rob is very well prepared. I asked him how he does it, and he says, "Well, you know, I had to manage a band of rock and rollers, and you got to realize that they're not always punctual." So he knows how to get people at point A to point B, so we can. But look, he can manage 100 to 130 people and make sure everybody gets covered, so nobody's sitting there going "duh."
Mm-hmm. Right.
If one person isn't there with the widget, then you're hosed and you can't shoot the scene.
Right.
And your producer and your investors are going, "What I thought you could produce." A lot of people think they're producers and they haven't a clue.
Mm-hmm. But he knows the deal.
In the extra footage on the Devil's Rejects, it shows them sitting down at a reading and various production meetings. So you don't burn out your crew, you don't burn out your talent. You start your day, you get done, you're not going into overtime, everybody's happy. I like to, at the end of the day, if we're not shooting nights, I like to be home with my family if I'm local, but I live way in Northern California. But I would work with Rob anywhere, just about anywhere, but definitely anytime.
Yeah, and talk about someone, because we're talking about reimagining classic films like what they attempted with The Hills Have Eyes. His reimagining of Halloween was spectacular, I thought.
I have not seen it yet. I've been trying to.
You need to see it.
It's a great film.
It's sensational. So before you go, do you have any films in the pipeline? I saw that you have three or four films that are in various stages.
If you go to IMDb and put me in there, I have some very exciting films getting ready to come out. The most beloved is, of course, Andrew Getty's Storyteller. It stars myself as the cadaver, based on a nightmare Andrew had. And Fred Kohler is our serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
Dina Myers is engaged to Sean Patrick Flannery.
Huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just about everybody in L.A. on Yahtzee has worked on the film. It's a psychological horror thriller, independent film. It's shot on film. It looks gorgeous. The cinematography that we got, it was start and stop, on again and on, off again, privately funded for 3 years.
Mm.
The cinematography is exquisite.
And what is this film again?
Storyteller. Andrew Getty, J. Paul's grandson. He's in L.A., and we're getting our musical score right now. When it comes out, it's going to put I've got the title role. What can I tell you? The cadaver is awesome. I mean, just awesome. I have a couple other films. Of course, I did Dead Man's Hand with Sid Haig. I did Brutal with Sarah Thompson. I did Ed Gein with my dear friend Kane. I thought he did a great job. Some people were going, well, he should be skinnier. Kane can really emote. The guy's
it was
really talented.
Yeah,
I have a lovely film called Brothers War. It's about the connection between soldiers, the British, the Germans, the Russians, and the Americans. And on the fall of the Eastern Front, I play a Russian officer.
That sounds really cool.
It's a beautiful film produced by Tino Strickland. It is and it has a Masonic connection. Sworn enemies wind up saving each other's life and making sure that something that the world needs to find out during the events actually that it doesn't get buried by those that are trying to stop that information from the light of day. Let me see what else.
Are you looking on IMDb yourself?
No, I just kind of keep these in my head.
I know there's so much you got.
I've got a box.
You got a lot lined up. So.
I've got a box over here of about 15 scripts. Some are actively being funded, seeking funding. Some didn't have funding, but they're great. So, and that's the nature of the business. I'm always out there. Can't afford to retire, so being a character actor is kind of nice, knowing that you can work until you cack, you know.
Oh yeah, and we love watching your work, and
well, thank you.
We appreciate you so much.
Have you seen Brutal?
I have not seen
it.
No, we have not.
We're looking forward to it, but we haven't seen
it. It's out on DVD. I play an autistic bloodhound for the sheriff department guy, forensic fellow, who has OCD.
Mm.
And some wonderful characteristics, and I enjoy at this stage of the game after 3 decades. I really love having the moments, and I really appreciate being able to have my characters develop in such a manner that myself and my fans get an opportunity to see different shades of Michael Berryman and what I like to... Every character has a life of his own, and I make everyone a little bit of a nuance different. And my favorite to date has to be Owen Jarvis from The X-Files.
Yes, yes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for everything you do, and can't wait to check you out this weekend in Orlando.
This is a dream come true for me, so this is awesome.
It really is. It's been great to have you on the show, Mr. Berryman.
Well, don't wake up. Keep dreaming.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure, and to all my fans, just want to tell you that without you, I wouldn't be where I am. So bottom line is, everybody knows that Michael Berryman loves his fans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very
cool. Thank you.
Absolutely.
And thank you, George Powell.
Thank you so much, sir.
Good night,
thank
gentlemen.
You. Have a good night.
Bye-bye now. That's Michael Berryman, a great talent and a great guy. Check him out this weekend. He'll be in Orlando, Florida at the Scream Fest event all weekend. And The Hills Have Eyes is the classic horror film that he's...
Yes, it is.
Yeah, just amazing and a great pleasure to speak to him tonight. Our next guest has been on hold for a little while, and I apologize for the overage there, but are you ready to get to him right now, Jerry?
Yes, I am.
Let's do this. Now we turn from The Hills Have Eyes to a brand new fan favorite of the horror/comedy genre, the independent film Blood Car from writer-director Alex Orr. The film has enjoyed a dizzying run at the world's premier film festivals. It's taken home the best narrative feature at both the Chicago and Atlanta underground film festivals, and it won the coveted New Visions Award at Cinequest. Blood Car is also winning over the nation's top critics and some of the industry's most influential filmmakers. Dennis Harvey of Variety Magazine observes, "There's something charming about the feature, even at its most cheerfully tasteless." And meanwhile, director Jonathan Demme praises the film as extremely funny. We are pleased to be joined tonight by the picture's writer-director Alex Orr and co-star Katie Rowlett. Let me see if I can pull them up here. Alex, are you there?
Hello?
Alex, hi.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us tonight. And Katie, are you with us?
I am with you.
Thank you so much for calling in. I'm sorry we got to a late start here. I'm very excited to talk to you about Blood Car, but first I want to know a little bit about both of your personal journeys leading up to Blood Car. I know that you've both worked kind of behind the scenes in different capacities for a while. Can you tell me a little bit about how you broke into the business, starting with you, Alex?
Yeah, sure. I was going to college, and I was a history major, and started taking some film classes, and
mm-hmm.
realized that it was actually a job. So, started working randomly as a PA, and then, Griffin Electric, and, just basically learning the business till I was going to make a movie. Standard thing. Me and a few guys at Fakewood Wallpaper, that's our production company, we've been working on each other's shorts for years, and we come up with the idea to make a really cheap feature, so off we went, and it became Blood Car.
Mm. So this is your first feature directorial work, Blood Car.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kenny. How about you? Have you always wanted to be an actress, or at least be in the business?
Yeah. I definitely always wanted to do something with acting, and I did theater, and I studied theater in college. I went to the same college as Alex and the other Fakewood Wallpaper guys, and that's where I met them, and I worked on their shorts with them all through college, and Blood Car was also my first feature, and I actually got into production right after Blood Car. That's when I started working in the art department around Atlanta and doing other PA work and scripty work.
Okay. Well, and you just recently did, your production assistant on the new Jonathan Demme documentary on Jimmy Carter?
Yes. Yes.
I'm excited about that project, too. That looks amazing.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Mike Bruni, who is the lead actor in Blood Car, he was hired on as the Atlanta coordinator for the Jonathan Demme movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so he hired Alex and I as his PAs, which was just a really great experience. Cause we basically just we went down to Plains in November, where Jimmy Carter's from, and we were like the van drivers. So we picked up Jonathan Demme and Declan Quinn and the crew, and we drove them down to Plains, Georgia, and spent 3 or 4 days with them, and then they came back down in December to go to the Carter Center in Atlanta and Emory University in Atlanta, and we worked with them again. And then in January, the same crew, we went back down to Plains. So it was really great. It was spanned over about 3 months, and, it was a very small crew, say about 8 or 9 people, and so we got to spend a lot of time with Jonathan Demme and everybody, so it was really cool.
Oh, that had to have been a thrill. Alex, tell me about Blood Car. What ideas first inspired you to write the screenplay, and tell me a little bit about the premise of the film.
Well, the premise of the film is, in the near future, about 2 weeks from now, gas prices are $30 a gallon, and a vegan kindergarten teacher is trying to invent a car that runs on wheatgrass, and he accidentally invents a car that runs on blood.
That sounds great. I mean, that really does. And you weren't going for necessarily a horror film, or were you?
Well, yeah. Our original intention was, we wanted to make something. We had a really limited budget, and we wanted to make something that, people would get to see. And, generally, if you're working in a really low budget, horror is, horror fans are a little more forgiving of, not necessarily having, like, A-list talent and, $100 million, if you can have fun and pull off a silly horror movie, you can usually find an audience for it, as opposed to a really low budget.
Absolutely.
Rom,
yeah.
Or something like that. So initially our idea was to make a low budget horror movie. We're pitching around ideas. And somebody came up with Car That Runs on Blood, and we all write a lot of comedy. So it was just a forum for myself and the co-writer, Adam Tenney, and Hugh Bradleton also helped us come up with the story. We just all started riffing on a lot of jokes, like, really quickly, and the writing process just went really fast, and it's just a good platform for there are a lot of funny characters in it, like Mike Rooney plays a vegan school teacher, and Eddie Rolette's got a really hilarious part as a girl who runs the meat stand.
Denise,
and,
yeah. So, Katie, tell me about your character, Denise.
Well, the way that I was approached about the character, Alex and Hugh and Adam have been driving around coming up with the story, and Alex just texted me and said, "Do you want to play a really nasty, slutty girl who does Mike Rooney the whole movie?" And I was like, "Yes." So, I guess we talked about it, and I read the script, and we were basically just, Alex kind of clued me into the fact of having the little love triangle sort of going on, and Lorraine, played by Anna Chlumsky, who runs the vegetable stand, would be the all-out good girl.
Uh-huh.
And I would just be the absolute opposite of that, working at the meat stand. And basically the downfall of Mike Bruni, because I'm willing to do any kind of sexual thing with a guy who has a car because nobody drives anymore. So, and we kind of came up with the dialogue together. It was luckily sort of written for me. I've got a filthy mouth when I want to. So it was just really, really fun with Alex and Mike just coming up with just some ridiculous lines to say and just, you know, just actually just pushing it to the limit of how filthy I could be, but still trying to remain sexy at the same time. So.
So Anna Chlumsky is one of the co-stars of the film, and of course we all know her from My Girl and several other films, but what brought her to mind for the part of Lorraine, and how did you get her, Alex?
Well, you know, if you're familiar with the careers of some of the other child stars from that era, usually end pretty badly, and Anna was actually living in the alley behind my apartment. You know, strung out on drugs, just a horrible, horrible sight. We nursed her back to health and gave her a job, and she ended up doing really well. No, that's totally a joke.
No, that's very noble of you.
Yeah.
No, I worked a really small movie in Myrtle Beach. I was a gaffer on, and Anna was there, and it was like a 4-person crew, and you know, only like 4 or 5 cast members. So we all got to be really, you know, really good friends. Everybody was on the road. So, you know, after you finish a day, you know, we're all hanging out, and we got along really well, and we wrote the part for kind of the nerdy vegan girl. We called Anna to see if she wanted to do it, and she was down, and we brought her down to Atlanta for a few days, and, we had a great time.
So tell me a little bit about your budget on this was, what, something like $25,000?
Yeah. Well, during production, we only had about $14,000, which was, you know, amazingly, a lot of people say, you know, how did you pay your crew, or, you know, this sort of thing. Where'd you get your money? How'd you pay your crew? And I don't know the answer to either one of those questions, because we originally only had a couple $1,000s. But then when we just started circulating the script and saying, we're just going to run out and shoot this with our video camera, people would read it and say, no, this is actually funny. Do you need a little more money? And people would agree to work, and they'd even agree to, you know, donate money towards the film or become investors or... You know, so our money came from just, like, really, like, crew and cast, and everybody just chipped in so we could, you know, get a decent camera, get some gear, you know, and our parents fed us. I think after posts and everything, we had, like, $25,000, but, you know, which is really, like, absolutely nothing. We had just huge favors from the Atlanta film community. So we shot the movie wholly in, you know, in Atlanta, in the metro area.
Mm. Now, is there, I can imagine the pitfalls of working on a minuscule budget, but are there any benefits to working on the cheap?
Oh, yeah. Well, especially when you see the film, you can see that really we don't have to answer to anyone because, no one's worried about losing their money. So it's just so freeing. You know, we can tell the story however we want. We can experiment, there's some things in the movie that, you know, are just horribly filthy and hilarious. Nobody who was, you know, worried about getting a return on their investment, whatever, you know, even try in fear of just, like, alienating large groups of the audience.
Right.
But, and it's like your decisions become very simple. They become, can we afford that? No. Okay, let's figure out what we can do. It's great. And, it, you know, it turns the crew into, you know, you have no such thing as, like, somebody just kind of hanging around the set to be on the scene. You know, people are only there that, like, really want to be there and really want to work. Yeah, it's a great, you know, and you just really learn, what's important, what's not when you're making a movie. It's a great way to learn to start off with because, you know, your problems can't just be washed away with, you know, writing another check or, you know, fixing it with a lot of money. You've got to be really creative.
It
and
demands
really,
a know, creative you know. Solution for everything. Yeah, absolutely. And I've read review after review of this film have stated that although your budget might have been small, the look of the film, it looks like a film that was done with several times the budget you guys had. So how do you go about accomplishing that?
Well, I've worked on several low-budget features, as have most of the guys around me. And most of the guys that, you know, like our DP credits split between Adam Penny and Chris Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Adam is just like, he's just a phenomenal camera operator. And Chris is you know, Chris was the lighting director on The Signal, another horror movie shot of Atlanta.
Right, right.
It's scheduled for release. You know, and you just luck out that your friends just happen to be really good technicians and, you know, think you're good enough to come out and work for free for. And, you know, also, you know, just for years, you know, you just realize after a while that, like, really if you want to make a movie, just be sure that, you know, just in case someone doesn't show up, you can do their job too. And,
yeah.
You know, just between, like, me and a few friends that we have, you know, we weren't ever faced with it too much, but, you know, we can get by in most of the departments. You know, we can kind of double team, and, you know, we're really not at the whim of, you know, hopefully the crew doesn't walk out, because we really didn't expect them to show up in the first place. So, you know, they did, and it made it, you know, that much better.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all do double duty. Like, Katie was even our, you know, our props master. So, you know, on the days that Katie wasn't working as a filthy slut, she was, you know, dressing out the rooms and doing our props. And would you do the whole props budget for the movie for, like, $15 or something, Katie?
No, well, I spent, like, between $30 and $40, I think, for all the props on the movie. And Robert Paraguasu, our set designer, he was just so into it. Like Alex said, I mean, people really just want to be there. They're not there to get paid. And so, you know, everybody just was so creative and just so into it. And I was actually teaching at the time. I was teaching English at night to adults that don't speak English. So I had, like, a classroom that was just full of stuff that you would see in a kindergarten room, because it was just very, very basic English. So we actually took all the stuff out of my classroom over the weekend when I wasn't in class because it was Christmas time, and dressed out this empty schoolroom to make it look like Archie's classroom. And so we really just, I mean, we pulled absolutely everything from, you know, I mean, we did not spend any money. I spent like about $30 on all the props. So
wow.
It was just a lot of favors and a lot of creativity, I would say.
Yeah, very much so. And I would imagine that a real feeling of camaraderie with everyone that's kind of in that trench hole with you, you know, where everyone just pitches in, that's fantastic.
You would think that there was a really definite sense of camaraderie in that everyone hated me, I think. Everyone was like, we can all know that at the end of the day, you know, we'll all not really want to hang around Alex anymore.
That's definitely true. That's true. Because we're all very excited to be doing a feature together. We'd all done so many shorts together, and I mean, we were just all just, you know, just high running on this. But Alex was definitely the bad apple. I mean, he was just, you know, he was stressing all the time. But we can find camaraderie in hating Alex. So that was, I mean, I think Mike Bruni by like the 11th and 12th day, the last days of shooting, Mike Bruni was worn down as well, and he was being a brat, but he's not a brat like Alex is a brat. So at the end of the day, I mean, we were all just still having a good time and making fun of Alex. So, yeah.
So Alex, I'm giving you a chance to defend yourself here. Did you
go ahead, Alex?
Did you take well?
No, I can't defend myself like whatsoever. I mean, I was an AD on the past five features, so I have been trained to be an asshole basically five movies previous. So no, definitely, I'm used to being the bad guy. I actually kind of enjoy it. No, I have nothing to say.
Well,
I have
really
sweet, nice friends that put up the...
So you've been touring the festival circuit pretty nonstop. You guys have been everywhere with the film. What have some of your impressions been of that whole experience of the festival circuit?
Oh, I love it. Oh, I actually got word today that we actually won Best Feature Film at First Glance Philadelphia also.
Oh, gosh.
Congratulations.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, no, the festival circuit's fun. I got back from the Austin Film Festival yesterday, and Friday I leave to go to the Indie Memphis. And I mean, yeah, since the first one we went to, which was CineQuest, I'm just trying to figure out how to get another movie made so I can go back and, you know, do festivals. It's just so much fun, you know, and, you know, you're hanging out with filmmakers and watching movies and, you know, and partying. It's just like, I mean, I don't know. I'm the kind of person that can easily watch, you know, four or five movies a day, just in the theater all day long.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I love film festivals. They're great.
Yeah, me too. Katie, what have been some of your fondest experiences from sharing this movie with audiences?
Oh, God. I don't know. It's just really fun. We really planned for this year just to be, you know, a film festival year for us. We moved into a cheaper apartment and just got rid of a bunch of stuff and just kind of cleared our schedules. And It was just really exciting. I mean, the Cinequest, we all went out and, like, we had just a huge group of people for our premiere, and started off like we were really burning bright there for a few festivals, which was fun, but then I think we kind of calmed down after a few festivals and just started really, I mean, we are true movie geeks. Like, I mean, we are just obsessed with movies, so I don't know, Alex and I mean, our favorite thing to do is to go to be at a festival and just, like, corner some guy who loves movies too and just scream about movies and just drink and just scream about movies until all hours of the night, and, like,
sounds
just meeting so many people. And you know, like Alex said, there's a lot of other filmmakers that we've you know, ran into over and over and over again at different festivals, so it's kind of like we have our own little filmmaker community with these people, which is really cool. And just, yeah, like, you know, we'll just to go and see all the movies we want for free, and just, I mean, it's just a great, great time.
I'm with you. I'm crazy about film festivals. I'm with you absolutely. Blood Car, it's currently in theaters in a theatrical run, a limited theatrical run, and then it comes out on DVD in December. Am I correct?
No, it's actually out on DVD November 6th. But I'm kind of doing, you know, TLA is releasing the film on DVD, but I'm kind of doing the theatrical from my apartment here, just, you know, just using the internet, making phone calls, and, you know, trying to get screenings in some of the cities that, you know, that haven't seen the film. If, actually, if anybody's listening, knows of a theater in your city, contact me through the Blood Car MySpace page, and, you know, I'll do my best to book it there. But, yeah, we've been doing fairly well with it. We've actually booked it in a few cities as, like, a, you know, kind of a Halloween double feature with Murder Party.
Oh.
Which is a film that has been playing the Fest circuit along with us this year. They, you can see them in the last, you know, issue of Rolling Stone. They won the Audience Award at Slam Dance. Really funny movie. But you know, we're playing like Denver and Portland with those guys, and we did a week in Washington. We did a week in Athens, Georgia. We're playing Seattle and Tampa, and, you know, several cities. Hopefully, the list will keep growing. But I try to keep those updated on our website, but. Yeah, it's not really a theatrical run, as in we're not, you know, we're not playing for a week here and there. We're playing for like a day here and there, or 2 days.
Okay, but our listeners can check out your MySpace page, and do you also have a website that they can look to for updates?
Oh yeah, bloodcar.com, and that has links to everything. Bloodcar.com does. There's a blog we keep updated there, and, you know, you can see a trailer, and within the next couple days, you'll be able to pre-order a DVD there.
Great.
Oh, cool.
You can also link to Alex's Fakewood Wallpaper website and see some of the shorts we did in college, which, you know, if you're into that.
Fakewoodwallpaper.com?
Yeah, there's a link from that, from bloodcar.com, going to their website with all of our shorts. So.
All righty. Well, fantastic. Alex and Katie, anytime you guys want to talk movies,
please come back.
Just stop back by and let's do it.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah, we both went and saw... The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford a few hours ago.
That was great. Great movie.
Have you seen this? That movie's awesome.
Jerry.
Yeah, like, run, don't walk to that movie. It's a masterpiece.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and call back anytime you'd like. Thanks so much for being our guest tonight.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Alex and Katie. The movie is called Blood Car. It's in limited release now in theaters. Check for additional markets at bloodcar.com or their MySpace page, which I assume would be myspace.com/bloodcar. All right, Guy. Jerry?
All right, yeah.
All right, Guy. Like,
I know, I like that.
Well,
great show tonight.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very good show. Check with us on Sunday night. We have a Stanley Kubrick tribute with several of the members of the cast and crew from Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut. It's going to be an amazing show right there.
Yes, it will.
And next Wednesday, we have the star of Saw 4, Lyric Bent, and we have a special little tribute to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original film with the picture cinematographer and documentarian. Special thanks to Tiffany Littleton for another terrific intro tonight, and we will see you back here Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, good night, everyone.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.